Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a new women's resource center is already filled to capacity, and then some, just weeks after opening. The LDS Church opposes a proposed ban on conversion therapy in Utah. Environmental organizations request a halt on construction at the Utah Inland Port and more. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Good morning and welcome to you, Matt.
Good morning.
Also here in studio is reporter Taylor Stevens. And hi, Taylor. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And joining us as well is George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Tribune. And good morning and welcome to you, George.
Good morning.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We're going to begin today with so-called conversion therapy. Matt Canham, there's an effort underway, as there has been for some time, to get the practice banned here in the state of Utah. The practice has been discredited in some camps. It's the idea that you can change a person's sexual orientation with therapy, and there's kind of a long history in the state with that. Maybe to start with, can we talk about where the state is on this and the efforts to get this practice banned here in Utah, where we've been seeing efforts along those lines for a number of years now?
Yes, an effort at the state legislature to ban it fell apart when far-right groups attacked it and some Republican members got a little cold feet. In response to that, Governor Gary Herbert, who actually for a moment was supportive of ending that or eliminating that bill and not banning conversion therapy, had a bit of a change of heart, and he pushed for a change in rules. And there's some logic to this. This is, you know, we have the Division of Occupational and Professional Licensing. Therapists are licensed, and so there are rules of conduct for these professional professions. They decided, why don't we try going the rule way to limit something that, as you pointed out, has been discredited by professional organizations in our state, in our country, and throughout the world. They have found, these professional organizations have found, therapeutic practices intended to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity is wildly harmful, leads people to increase of self-harm and risky behaviors, makes them withdraw from society where they have less job prospects even. And it's not successful. So there's efforts to go through by rule and make this happen. They had intense testimony at an emotional 3-hour meeting. And at that point, it goes to the public comment period. And that ended this week. And they received about 2,500 public comments. They are still sifting through those. So we don't know how many were for or against. We don't know where they all came from. One of the ones we do know where it came from was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its Family Services, which is one of the state's biggest therapeutic providers. On the last day of the public comment period, they expressed their opposition.
Why? Why are they opposed?
It's a little detailed. I mean, it's an 8-page letter that goes through a number of things. But generally, what they said is that they think it the rule as currently stated is too ambiguous and has overreaching areas. They think that it could stop what they believe to be realistic and legitimate therapeutic practices when it comes to someone's kid's confusion is the way they would consider it, or even issues about pornography. They also are not on board with the gender identity part of this. And we've seen that with the LDS Church this year. They had one of their leaders, Dallin Oaks, give an address that says that they don't believe they believe that the gender binary world that we have traditionally lived in is something that is immutable and it comes from birth. And so people who don't fit on that binary maybe do need some help. And so they're not on board with that part as well.
And that's part of the rule change is
yes,
okay.
Is. The
LDS Church itself has used this practice in the past, hasn't it? I mean, conversion therapy to try and affect change on people's sexual orientation, right?
Yes. Historically, the LDS Church has encouraged this, and lots of individual members have, when they have had a child come out to them, have tried to change that child's sexual orientation or gender identity, and through a variety of ways, including therapy. It's obviously they have religious tenets that have changed on this topic too, because they now believe that that if you are a gay person, that that actually is a thing. Before, they thought it was a psychological situation. They don't anymore. And they have actually walked back on this too. The LDS Church itself agrees that conversion therapy is harmful and should be limited. They supported a bill that was at the legislature. So they are not 100% black and white on this issue, but this is a rule that they don't agree with. They're actually, their argument is that this should go back to the legislature.
In its news release, the church says that the rule fails to protect individual religious beliefs and doesn't account for important realities of gender identity in the development of children. Is this an issue of, you know, religious freedom versus individual freedom? Is that maybe that could be a question for George Pyle over here, the columnist. But is that the way the church is trying to paint it, I guess, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, the church is saying that, look, there's a way to do this. They don't like this specific rule. And, you know, that's what the public comment period is about. If they are a obvious constituency in the state, as I said, they run one of the largest therapy providers in this state. So hearing from them kind of makes sense in that way. They want to see the rule altered. What they're not saying is that there shouldn't be any sort of restrictions on conversion therapy. It's how they write it, and they don't like this rule as it currently stands.
How has Utah's LGBTQ community responded to the church coming out in opposition to this?
Troy Williams, he's the executive director of Equality Utah, which was behind the bill that failed in the legislature. His response was that he was profoundly disappointed by the church's statement. His quote was, "The proposed rule would do nothing more than protect LGBTQ children from conversion therapy." And he goes through the studies that talk about how dangerous this practice is. On the flip side of that, you have people like Gail Ruzicka and the Eagle Forum, or groups that were tried to keep conversion therapy legal. And they don't think this licensing board acting at the governor's direction is the way to do this. She believes that there's honest conversion therapy possible. Now, so she's on the far right. Obviously, Equality Utah has its position, and the church is somewhere in the middle.
Let's go to George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Tribune. And the last time you were in on the show, we talked about the comments by Dallin Oaks, the church higher up that Matt was just talking about. We didn't talk about what the church is saying now. The Tribune editorial board took a stance on this, didn't they, George?
Yeah, very firmly in favor of banning. When you're in favor of banning something, that's kind of circular. But we are in favor of a ban of conversion therapy on minors, which is what this rule would do. It would not touch adults who may think they would need to go through this. But the considered scientific opinion of this right now is that conversion therapy is basically child abuse, and therefore it should be illegal. And the proposed rule, you have to read like the whole section of rules to get down to this one paragraph, and it basically says, don't do conversion therapy on minors. So apparently the church and some others think that that isn't specific enough. But I think it's clear that conversion therapy on minors, on the belief, is clearly based on religion, not science. And you read the church's statement, not their 8-page comment, but their press statement, where they say that they hope people who they work better than this, but people who are gay or transgender can find comfort in their family and stuff. What they are saying is that being gay is wrong, that it's a sickness that can be treated if not cured. There is no scientific basis for that. It is religion, pure and simple, and it should be kept out of the rulemaking and the lawmaking of this in any state. I mean, just and as I said when we were talking about this before, just how many millennial members does the church want to lose? I mean, this is almost like they've decided that they're going to be a church for old people, that they have no hope with young Americans. Maybe, you know, they're not growing here. They're growing in South America and places like that. And so they give up, and they're just going to be what they are and stick to it and be part of the trend. I mean, the Pew Research people came out just the other day. The number of people who identify as Christians has plummeted in the last decade. The number of people who identify as atheist, agnostic, or just nothing in particular is now more than a quarter of the adult population. Among millennials, it's 40%. And this has to be one of the big reasons, is that people look at not just the Mormon Church, but religion in general, see them as retrograde on women's rights, on women's issues, on same-sex marriage, on all this other stuff, and they're just leaving.
George, pointing to a sort of bigger, maybe not public relations, but attractiveness issue for the church going forward, based on these kinds of stances. Matt Canham, I want to go back to you just for a minute here on this before we turn to other news. Just so that we are clear, the science behind this, the American, what is it, Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association?
All of them.
They come
literally
out
all of them
and say that this practice is seen as pointless and then also probably harmful at the same time.
Right. I mean, it is, and it's broadly harmful. And I think sometimes when we talk about these kind of things, we jump straight to suicide. And obviously that is a very horrendous outcome, and it is an increase in those suicidal thoughts and actions. But there are lots of other ramifications. As I said, this goes down to how much they make and what their educational attainment is. If you, you know, are at odds with yourself and you're fighting and you're going to therapy and you want to change and it's not changing, if you could think about how psychologically damaging that would be, how would it not affect your relationships and your ability to function in society? Railing against who you are is very hard. We just posted a column this morning from Marina Gomberg. She is a columnist who herself is a member of the LGBTQ community, and she has five things that she wants people who are in this therapy to know. And I think if there's anyone out there who is in that situation, they should definitely read that. They should search for Marina Gomberg.
Okay. Check that out at sltrip.com. Matt, is what happens next as far as this rule goes or the efforts to maybe in the legislature attempt to ban conversion therapy in Utah?
So we finished the public comment phase, which means the Division of Occupational and Professional Licensing will go through the 2,500 comments, read them, consider if there should be a change to that rule, and essentially put that rule in place. I don't think that the church's statement on its face will stop this rule from moving forward. But as you pointed out, what about the legislature? The legislature meets in January. They have the right to change any rule they want to change. So I don't think this rule being put in place by the state government will be the end of this conversation, particularly if the church wants something changed. They have quite a significant amount of sway at the state legislature.
How about you mentioned that the governor was called for this rule change.
Right.
Has he commented after the church made its statement?
Not in any sort of substantive way. Essentially, he acknowledged that they gave us a statement and that the public comment period has ended, but he has not responded to the what the LDS Church has said.
Okay. Again, that's Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are going to take a quick break in the show and turn to more stories from this past week in Utah news when we return. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Taylor Stevens, and editorial page editor George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and again, you are invited to join us by calling 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us at KCPW is our handle. Well, two stories this week related to the Utah Inland Port. And Matt Canham, I'd like to start first with a press conference a number of environmental organizations held at the site of some construction that's happening right now out in Salt Lake City's northwest quadrant at the site of the Utah Inland Port. This is inside of port boundaries. These environmentalists want this construction to stop right away. Why is that?
They don't think that the government, all the government entities that are involved in here, have done the appropriate environmental and health assessments. And they wanted to have this news conference at the location so that the location itself can help make the point. While they were there, antelope ran by. While they were there, a truck drove by and kicked up a significant amount of dust. Birds flew overhead. These are the kind of things they wanted to point and say, we haven't taken this into consideration. We haven't done enough research to know what is the impact of building these massive warehouses and then at some point connecting them into an inland port. They want that construction, which is happening out there, to stop.
What is the construction that's happening out there? And that could be a question for you or Taylor Stevens.
Right now there are some warehouses, and I think Taylor might know a little bit more than I do. I think some people might know that we have an Amazon fulfillment center out there, which is one of these massive Amazon warehouses. This is next to that. There are other buildings being built out there that have been in the works for quite a while, I assume. But not necessarily. I mean, I think there's a little bit of debate over whether it's inland port land. It's pretty much part. They're advertising it as part of the inland port.
I thought, this is a question for Taylor Stevens, actually, which is that I thought we didn't have a plan for the port yet, an actual business plan, an operational plan. So what's, why is construction happening within the, is it within the port boundaries, actually, Taylor?
Yeah, so it gets a little complicated because, as Matt mentioned, there are a lot of government agencies involved in this. The construction that's happening now, as we understand it, has gone through Salt Lake City's process and has been under Salt Lake City control. But it is kind of part of this broader kind of area that's planned to become an inland port. So at the inland port meeting last night, the first in 4 months, the board did say, we don't have a plan yet. We don't really know what this is going to become. If you're mad about this construction, talk to Salt Lake City.
Okay. But so this is happening right now, but there hasn't been, as these environmentalists are pointing out, Matt, environmental studies in advance of the construction that is happening out there at this exact moment. Is that correct?
Right, and this is industrial use. It's what is this whole inland port is going to be. And so they're worried about what's stored out there, if there's any sort of potential runoff of pollutants and what that means. They're worried about truck traffic in particular. And there's bird refuge out there and animals out there. They're worried about a number of things that, as a state, we're worried about in general. And they want to slow down a process that there are a lot of other entities that want to speed up. And so that's really where the conflict is.
The president of Great Salt Lake Audubon said that talked about uncontrolled or untreated runoff.
Right.
And that could include toxic pollutants and the impact that might have on the lake. She mentioned antifreeze, grease, oil, and heavy metals. The entities that are actually constructing this is approved by Salt Lake City, as Inland Port Board members are pointing out. Go and complain to the city if you have a question about this. But what do the sort of organizations or the company behind the building, do we know what they say to this sort of protest from environmentalists?
Do you have an answer to that one? I mean, I think essentially we have seen this ratcheting up of rhetoric about what should happen out there and what the process should be. And while we have had meetings of the Inland Port Board and we have had massive protests, it appears that we're still in the early days. As we talked about, the building out there is things that were already in the works. There is an industrial area on the northwest quadrant already. It has been there for decades. So this is they're talking about a drastic expansion of it. So I think these activists are looking at these two buildings as a visual representation of their broader concerns. So I think it's going to come down to what the Inland Port Authority Board ends up actually deciding. And I think and I think Taylor might know more about this. The executive director over there has talked about the environmental concerns that he's starting to hear it too.
Taylor, yeah, what does Jack Hedge, the new relatively new executive director of the Utah Inland Port, say?
Yeah, I mean, he points out that this is privately owned land. The Inland Port Authority does not own the land and therefore doesn't have full control over how this develops. What he says the Inland Port Board has the authority to do is to set tax increment policies that can determine how basically they incentivize people to build the kind of developments that you would want to see out there or that these protesters would want to see out there. So can they incentivize, we will give you kind of tax breaks in exchange for you kind of holding to these certain environmental standards. And we don't have an idea yet of what that's going to look like.
It's interesting. I mean, one thing you said there that strikes me as possibly complicated is the kind of development that, environmentalists would like to see out there. Isn't that nothing?
Well, there's, this is not a homogenous landscape. It's 16,000 acres, and I think there is agreement that they want to protect as much of the land north of I-80, which is, more wetlands, globally significant bird habitat. And as Matt mentioned, this area kind of south of I-80 has already seen this kind of industrial development, and I don't think they're quite as worried about that. So there are people who, just are saying, we don't want to see any development in this area at all. I think there are others who recognize that's maybe unlikely and that they're doing as much as they can to protect the portions that are most at risk ecologically.
Okay. So we mentioned the concerns about pollution, groundwater contamination, impact on wildlife. I want to turn to something that happened just last night, which was, Taylor Stevens, you went to a board meeting of the Utah Inland Port, and it's the first one that's happened in quite a while. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen before, people who are opposed to this project showed up to make their voices heard. What happened at this meeting?
Yes, this was a meeting at the state capitol. They had security kind of from the second that you went to walk into the House building. And it was, in some ways, a relatively tame meeting. No one was arrested, as we've seen it last at previous meetings. However, we did see protests as kind of the meeting was getting underway, the board trying to conduct its work. It didn't do a ton, actually, to move forward this development, but made some administrative changes. The members of the public who were there, some of them wearing surgical masks, they had, I guess, whistles underneath their surgical masks, and during the meeting started kind of blowing those in unison, kind of drowning out the work of the board. And I actually completely missed their election for vice chair because you just couldn't really hear. There were a lot of Utah Highway Patrol officers on hand to kind of control the meeting. Most of the protesters complied and were walked out without incident. There was one person who kind of resisted officers and was carried out horizontally out of the meeting. A lot of signs, but the board did make it all the way through its meeting, which didn't happen in April when protesters came. So I don't know if they see that as a success or not.
You mentioned that it's been 4 months since the last meeting. Has the board been conducting any business besides this? Meaning, is this really the first time that they've done anything in 4 months?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're hearing. Obviously, we don't know what's going on kind of behind the scenes, but what we're being told is that Jack Hedge, the new executive director who was brought on, elected at the June meeting, which was the last meeting they held, has been doing a lot just kind of behind the scenes to get things ready to go, get staff in place, get kind of everything smoothed out, because they are really in these first stages of just kind of creating themselves. But I was surprised that we didn't see a little bit more work. They have been conducting with Envision Utah public engagement process. We saw that come out last week, kind of the results of that public engagement, which revealed what many of, I think, the people who are watching this knew already, which is that a lot of people are opposed to this and have a lot of concerns. But they say, we're going to take into consideration the results of the Envision Utah process, the public engagement process, to kind of build the business plan, which we talked about earlier, and they're expecting that to be revealed early next year. So we'll have a little few more answers early in the new year about what this might look like.
There, speaking of concerns about the port, a caller called in, didn't stay on the line. This is Chris from St. George, who asked if the pollution, I guess he says the winds from the inland port, would that push pollution into the valley and cause a worse inversion? Maybe he means emissions from vehicles. Is there a way of answering that? Do we have...
As far as winds go, I mean, there are definite concerns about that with dust, for example, from development. Also, a colleague, Bethany Rogers, and I wrote recently about mosquito abatement in the area. There's concerns that those pesticides could kind of blow in on the drying Great Salt Lake. And as far as pollution, I think we're just... kind of expecting, the protesters are expecting increased truck traffic and rail emissions to increase that air pollution. So,
okay, so again, there are these people who cite, you know, as you said, the Envision Utah process showed that there's a lot of people opposed to this. Those who cite environmental concerns, especially from increased truck and rail traffic, as you're mentioning. A successful port, wouldn't it bring increased truck and rail traffic one way or another? I mean, you're increasing the amount of activity, the amount of people who are bringing goods to an area. That's sort of the objective of the port, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that the Inland Port Board would say that with green technology, they can build it right from the beginning. But you're right, that is the concern. And we saw that from members of the public last night. They said that they think creating a green port is a fairy tale, as one person called it. So there's definitely that back and forth. And again, right now, we don't really know what this is going to look like.
I guess what I'm hinting at with that question, and this is a point to bring George Pyle in on from the columnist's perspective, is that there isn't really a lot of middle ground here for protesters or for the port board to work with. You've got, you know, all or nothing on both sides. George Pyle, do you see it any differently than I do on that?
I think... Because if you look back at the history of this, the land was already zoned industrial. It was already envisioned by the city as an inland port because it's next to an airport, it's next to major highways, it's next to rail lines. Nobody's going to want to put a daybreak out there. What's it good for if you assume development of any kind? Industrial, warehouses, distribution centers, things like that. We're past the days where we build, you know, smokestacks and things like that. So it's not going to be that kind of pollution, but trucks, trains, the dust that's stirred up by construction, the damage it might do to the wetlands that are right up against the lake. So, and then when the state came along, it kind of focused attention on this that hadn't really been there before. Under the city, it had sort of been developing piecemeal. You had an application, you had a rezoning, you had a tax increment financing request, but it wasn't the whole quadrant of the city all considered at once. When the legislature came on, created this board, it got everybody's attention, and my knee-jerk reaction was there is one reason and one reason only for the state to do this. The state wants to make sure that the environmental concerns will be minimal, because if the city controls it, one would think that the environmental concerns would be significant. Now, here's how the Inland Board, they'd have to turn their back on both the city and the legislature to do this. The Inland Port Board could gobsmack everybody by making all kinds of rules that would make this as green as such a thing can be and require lots of electric vehicles rather than gas-burning forklifts and switch engines and all that kind of stuff, could make a significant reservation for the wetlands and the bird sanctuary and just make it very clear that this is off limits. Could put lots of requirements on the people who want to develop there if they want any kind of tax increment financing. They have to be just as green as this kind of thing can be. Now, there's the argument that, like Ted Turner used to say about smart growth, there's no such thing as smart growth. All growth is dumb. But there's better and there's worse. The concern has been that why does the state want to take it over to bulldoze this thing? If the Port Board, which is its own entity, decides on its own that it's going to show them, it's going to do things that make it green, that make its operation green, that reserve wetlands, that don't allow shipping coal or things like that, they could leave a lot of people speechless.
Hmm. I mean, it's interesting, though. You're talking about the city having zoned it a specific way and the development that's already sort of considered a foregone conclusion. I'm wondering if it is considered a foregone conclusion. I mean, there are groups out there, and Matt Canham, maybe you can weigh in on this, who would like to see the zoning undone, I imagine. I don't know if that's even possible, but can you comment on that?
The city has thought it was a foregone conclusion. We've seen iterations over the decades. There was a plan to make a housing development out there. As Taylor and Bethany's story clearly explained, the mosquito problem would make that highly unlikely to be successful, but that was a plan the city actually had. They did change their master plan, and they talked about something that is remarkably similar to an inland port. They had extended rail where industrial buildings would be hubbed around it. Like, they didn't call it what this is, but they really leaned into how green they can make it. The city was planning to do this itself. What they don't like and what has created such pushback is the state taking control. And when you think about a conservative state board as opposed to the more progressive, so like city government doing it, you can see why environmental groups might think that they would have had more success with city leaders getting what they want than with maybe the state itself.
Taylor Stevens, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and when Matt says they took control, I mean, that's zoning authority and that's taxing. So they've lost all of the money from the new development in this area, as well as the ability to control how it develops. So as we've talked about on this show before, the city currently is suing the Inland Port Authority for the creation of the Inland Port. And so that is expected to have a hearing, I believe, next month, early next month. So we'll see how that goes and how that shakes out.
George Pyle.
It's interesting, too, that the mayor's race, a big issue in the mayor's race is which of them will hate the inland port more. And if you assume they both hate the inland port at the same, which of them will be more effective in killing it, controlling it, bringing it back to city control, or at least increasing the city's influence over it. So that does show that at the city level, it's a big issue, and it's not going away.
Just before we head to a break, Taylor Stevens, because you've covered both the Inland Port and the mayor's race, is there daylight between the candidates on on what they think of the Inland Port and how they want to address it?
This is complicated. I don't know if it's a very quick answer, but Escamilla, Senator Luz Escamilla, one of the candidates, voted against both of the bills, creating the one originally creating the Inland Port and then the one that the city had negotiated with lawmakers, kind of changing the some of the particulars of it. She voted against both of those. Erin Mendenhall, as a Salt Lake City Councilwoman, of course, did not have a vote. She worked with the legislature when the second bill came around to try and negotiate better conditions for Salt Lake City. So, you know, they both have opposed this.
There's basically no binary one is one way, one is the other
right.
Answer to that.
Okay. However, they have kind of pushed back on each other's records on the Inland Port. Luz Escamilla is sort of trying to make the argument that the city set the groundwork for the port. That also was a claim kind of echoed in Senator Jim DeBacchus's anti-endorsement of Erin Mendenhall that we reported on yesterday. So that's kind of been a little bit of a pushback through the race.
Wait, will you just quickly describe that anti-endorsement?
Yeah, I told you it wasn't an easy answer.
You're right, yeah.
Senator Jim DeBacchus, who was in the race during the primary, he was narrowly beat out by Senator Escamilla. He wrote an opinion on his Facebook page yesterday saying that he can't vote for Erin Mendenhall because of her role on the city council in kind of creating the Inland Port through the agreement that they made with developers that he thinks were kind of a bad spot for the city to be in. So I guess the short answer is it's complicated. They both say that they're against the port, but have recently begun kind of pushing back on the way each of them has sort of engaged with it from their respective government agencies.
Okay, that's Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. And Taylor, thanks once again for your coverage on this topic, both these topics or all of these topics. Maybe we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll talk about the Homeless Women's Resource Center here in Salt Lake City. Back in a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can call 801-355-8255 or tweet us. We are at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, I want to turn now to something that you covered at the beginning of this week, the opening of a new homeless women's resource center. A story that you and your colleague Bethany Rogers reported on. This was the first resource center to open after a sort of grand deal on homelessness a couple of years back. The gist of your story is that the center opened and it's already filled beyond capacity. Is that right?
Yeah, and so just to kind of explain the system, previously, the Road Home in the Rio Grande neighborhood had space for about 11,000 people and served both men and women just in that one single site. And it was more of kind of a, you have a bed, you leave during the day. So they envisioned this new system, three sites scattered around Salt Lake County, two in Salt Lake City, one in South Salt Lake. And two of the centers have space for women. So overall, there's space for 240 women within this system.
Okay.
And those beds are full. In the past, they haven't seen those kind of numbers for women entering the Road Home. And so the fact that women were taking up space at the Overflow Center at St. Vincent de Paul, which is just, you know, kind of mats on the floor, was concerning for a lot of advocates because that overflow space has kind of been considered as taking on the extra men. And, you know, we're kind of seeing already more women in the system. And the concern is that there would also be more men in the system once the third resource center opens. Next month is when it's planned to open. So that's kind of the concern advocates have is, are people going to be left on the streets in the cold after we've spent $63 million on this new homeless resource system?
You wrote, there's this quote from Bill Tibbetts, who's a poverty advocate in Salt Lake City, and he says, finding out that there's also not enough beds for women just means that the capacity issues are a bigger deal than we even thought, because the sort of concern has been, oh, we're not going to have enough beds for the homeless, for the single homeless men. But now this happening immediately, the fact that these filled up, or the Homeless Women's Resource Center filled up immediately, is cause for concern. What do the homeless service providers say about the fact that there are that many women in the system?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of see this as a good thing in a way, because we know that there were a lot of problems at the Road Home. A state audit revealed a lot of drug use and other problems within that facility. So they kind of see this as, you know, we've created this new system. It's safe. That's why women are accessing it. So it's a good thing because we're helping people get the services they need. It's worth noting that this isn't really a surprise in a way. I've written at least four stories over the last year and a half about concerns about the system. There are 700 beds among the three homeless resource centers compared to 1,100 capacity in the Road Home. So for a long time, people have been saying, you know, this math doesn't add up.
The idea was always that the homeless resource centers would be able to more quickly move people out of homelessness. Is it too early to know whether or not that strategy is working or feasible?
Yeah, we're hearing that they have moved some people into housing. One of the other problems, though, is with the affordable housing crisis that my colleague Tony Semerad has been covering extensively, there's not enough units, you know, even just for the average person in a lot of ways. And so getting landlords to accept vouchers for rental assistance can be difficult. So there's a lot at play in this. It's, you know, homelessness is complex. The forces around it are really complex. complex, but I think that, you know, the concern for people right now is how do we keep people warm through the winter, and how do we, you know, kind of create contingency plans in case St. Vincent's is full?
Are there enough beds for people out? I mean, you've been pointing, as you said, your reporting for a long time has been pointing to the fact that there will be a shortfall. Is it that right now people who want to come in from the cold during cold, you know, fall and winter nights won't be able to?
Well, there is an increase in the fall and winter months of people seeking shelter because it does get cold. We don't really know because the Third Resource Center hasn't opened yet, so we're not fully kind of in the new system. So I think that's still to be seen. State leaders say they're working on an overflow plan and that, you know, they're not going to let anybody be in the cold. They're not going to turn people away.
Matt Canham, senior managing editor with the Tribune. You know, Taylor's reporting and the reporting the Tribune has done points to the fact that this was something we've known about for quite a while. Just on the top, well, I don't know, I don't want you to comment with an opinion, but the fact that the shelter system is now at kind of capacity already, does that point to a crisis that could be coming? I don't know if you can answer that.
If it is a crisis, it's one that these people who have created this program created for themselves. And it's one that is focused or started with business at the heart of it. We have a shelter. It's called the Road Home downtown. It's big. It can hold up to 1,100 people. We don't have to close it. There is no contractual obligation to close it. It is a political decision to close it, and one that business interests in that area really want to see happen. They want to demolish the building and turn it into another development. And no one's saying that can't happen. We are hearing people, Aaron Mendenhall, one of the mayoral candidates, is one of them. Bill Tibbetts is another, that says, why don't we just leave it open for the winter? Because we don't have to come up with some grand, complicated plan. Just use the shelter we have at our disposal. But there are a lot of entrenched interests that are saying no, including the House Speaker.
Go ahead, Taylor. I was going to say, what are the entrenched interests here?
Yeah, well, I was just going to point out that the closure date for the Road Home was originally set in state mandate as June 30th, and that
year.
Obviously hasn't happened due to a lot of reasons, difficulty with permitting in South Salt Lake, a wet spring, financial challenges. So I think, you know, this has happened before, and advocates kind of point out why not keep it open when people might be cold. The other thing I was going to mention is that Bethany Rogers and I reported a story this week kind of unveiling the different kind of ways that state leaders are looking at addressing this problem.
Creative strategies.
Creative strategies, yes. They were looking at a shuttered state liquor store in the Ballpark neighborhood as a potential place for housing homeless individuals in case of a capacity crisis.
Are they still looking at that?
They had even moved mattresses into the building. However, you know, early in the day we heard that was kind of on the table, and by the end of the day they said, you know, that's no longer being considered. So we're hearing that's not on the table, but we don't really know exactly what the capacity plan is going to be. Right now, they're saying that they don't see keeping the Road Home open as an option, though.
George Pyle, I'll give you the sort of final word on this story, because I want to squeeze one more in before we head to the underplayed stories of the week. But not closing or closing the Road Home, maybe leaving it open through the winter. You got any comments there?
They are leaving it open through the winter. It would be less crowded because they are putting other people in these other resource centers. They are making some efforts. The whole thing that started with this, as I've said often on this show, is like they discovered gold on the Cheyenne Reservation, and all of a sudden it wasn't worthless land anymore. They had to chase the Indians off. Well, now the growth from downtown, the redevelopment of downtown, crowded this way, and now this land is valuable. They want to turn it into apartments or something, so the homeless people were in the way. They at least had either the decency or the political awareness to think, well, we can't just chase them off. We need to create this new system. Everybody knew it would be overcrowded at the beginning. It's like when you buy a house and you still own your last one and you're paying two mortgages, you hope that that won't last very long, but there's going to be an overlap. It's also like what happened in the 70s when they closed down all the mental hospitals all across the country and said, oh, good, we've closed down these horrible, awful mental hospitals, and they've been on the streets ever since. And for a while there, we acted like we solved the problem. We didn't solve it. We just moved it.
Some historical perspective, a variety of historical perspectives from George Pyle there. I want to just squeeze one more story in before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Matt Cannon, I'm going to ask you to kind of run through this given our truncated time frame. Yesterday, Senator Mitt Romney on the floor of the U.S. Senate took some time to criticize a decision by President Donald Trump. What did Romney say?
So first off, let's talk a little bit what the decision is. And that's in Syria. We have partnered with the Kurds to fight Islamic State terrorists. And that has been very successful. There are huge prisons where these fighters are now held. They are mostly without the ability to strike the way they used to. Turkey doesn't like the Kurds. Turkey wanted to fight the Kurds. Donald Trump allowed that to happen, has agreed to pull our troops out. And that means that we have allowed our allies to be attacked by Turkey. And Mitt Romney is on the Foreign Relations Committee, and he is wildly angry at this, as are a number of Republicans, including Mitch McConnell. But what Mitt Romney said on the floor of the Senate was the decision to abandon the Kurds violates one of our most sacred duties. It strikes at American honor. What we have done to the Kurds will stand as a blood stain in the annals of American history. It is really strikingly harsh language towards the president of his own party, and it goes to where Mitt Romney and many of the Republicans feel that we have made a promise to these people who fought by our side, and they are now dying because of a decision of our president.
There's a ceasefire that was announced that the president announced. It's a 5-day ceasefire. What does Romney say about that ceasefire?
He thinks that's an okay step, but why wasn't that negotiated before you removed your troops, is what he says. Why didn't we let the Kurds know we were going to make this action? Because it's clear that the administration let Turkey know because Turkey was able to attack quickly. We did not give our allies, the Kurds, a heads up that the U.S. was leaving, nor did the president give the Pentagon or the Senate or House any sort of heads up. It created a situation that a lot of people feel was very dishonorable.
George Pyle, a quick comment before we turn to the underplayed stories.
Well, this may not be the end. It may not be the beginning of the end, but it may be the end of the beginning. If we look back in 18 months, Donald Trump is gone. This may be it.
George Pyle is a columnist and editorial page editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. And with that, we will turn now to our final segment, the underplayed, or in case you missed it, segment of the show. And Taylor Stevens, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, what's your pick for underplayed story?
Yeah, I want to highlight a story by my colleague, Courtney Tanner. She wrote about a time capsule that was placed in the cornerstone of Ogden Academy when it was built in northern Utah by the Congregational Church. It switched hands and names a lot of times, but it was a fun read to kind of find out what was in it in 1887.
1887, and then opened up just this year. Check that out, sltrib.com. George Pyle, your pick for underplayed story.
All right. After all this bad news, we need something good. If you're listening to me live, get on your phone, go to nasa.gov, watch the first all-female spacewalk going on right now, which you can watch on your desktop, your phone, anything.
Pretty cool.
There are some good things in the world now.
Thanks, George, for that. Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to talk about a story that just posted from Bethany Rogers about the tax plan. The state is trying to, or state Republican leaders are trying to revamp our entire tax system, and they've created a proposal that would deliver a $75 million tax cut. To do that, they would lower your income taxes. But they had raised the taxes on groceries. They had raised the sale. They'd put a sales tax on gas. They would tax a variety of services, from whether that's going to a yoga studio or a vet. If you have someone that does landscaping, or you get in an Uber or Lyft, those things would now be taxed.
Wow.
It's a pretty broad plan that they're going to try to ram through by the end of the year. So, you should probably be on top of this because it will affect your taxes. That story is at sltrib.com right now.
And it's coming. Sorry, this plan is coming out of interim meetings at the legislature?
It's coming from a task force that was trying to come up with a plan that they think that our tax system needs to be modernized. And so this is their attempt at that. They also want to eliminate the requirement that all income taxes are spent on education. Which would be a very controversial action.
The earmark, yeah.
And it would be a constitutional amendment, so we'd all have to vote on that at some point.
Okay, again, that's a story that's just breaking now. For my part, I'm going to go with the story of a famous Utah outlaw, Butch Cassidy, his boyhood home not being included in the list of sites that will be designated as a state monument. This is in Circleville, Utah. There are some other sites, Danger Cave and Old Irontown, that are the leading candidates for these state monuments. I'm as a sort of outlaw, amateur outlaw historian, I want to see Butch Cassidy's boyhood home kept as preserved, I guess. That's my pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'm going to go and thank Taylor Stevens, Matt Canham, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. And I want to thank KCPW Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his work. Also, Tim Pierce, a producer, for his help on the show, and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. You can find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at our website, kcpw.org, or however you listen to podcasts. And sorry about this. You can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. We are at KCPW on Twitter, and you can just search KCPW 88.3 FM on Facebook to find us. I'm Roger McDonough. Thank you once again for listening to the show. Join us again next week.